Blog Talk Radio.
Good Saturday to you. Hi, everyone. This is Cliff, your host. Lots to talk about. We always go to the Facebook page. I can't believe what's going on Mars. The rover Curiosity continues to deliver an amazing array of photographs. Of course, NASA doesn't tell us or reveal to us what these images are all about, but a huge, huge number of research investigators on the planet, our planet, are turning up just tons of material from the surface of the planet, and it really looks like there was a devastation that literally bulldozed the whatever surface materials were there, and I've posted just recently a photograph of what looks like a standing column. And the article that I posted came from a message from the Eagle, which is a online series, messagetoeagle.com. And they took an article from an investigator that actually shows what looks like a column with hieroglyphs on it, and have tinted it slightly blue so that this hieroglyph can come off and you can actually see it. And it's beginning to seem like there was some civilization. We don't know how old, how long ago. People like Graham Hancock in his book Mystery of Mars dates the ruins to, you know, tens of thousands of years ago. Other people consider the ruins to be over 100,000 years ago. I don't know where they get these numbers. But in this one photograph, they show a symbol that appears to be an Egyptian symbol, and they've highlighted it with red. So take a look at it. The title of the article is Mystery and Unexplained Ancient Rock Carvings Depicting Humans discovered on Mars. I really don't like to cover anything having to do with planets outside of the Earth, but there is some connection. And we had author Mike Barra on the program a number of months ago, who actually has found a tremendous amount of connection between dynastic or pre-dynastic Egypt and the actual surface civilization on Mars. We don't know if this connection is Mars to Earth, in other words, civilizations developing on Mars, then coming to populate the Earth, or ancient Earth populations pre-deluge, pre-catastrophic event coming or developing high civilization on Earth and then going to Mars. It's just, we just don't know that. But I think at some point the NASA is going to have to come clean and go, look, we have evidence of a civilization, because some of these bits and pieces of buildings, perfectly cut stone blocks, and in even one case, a picture of a statue shows that there's some form of civilization that once existed on Mars. So, and some people feel there could be still people living underneath the planet's surface. So take a look at that. It's kind of an interesting point of view. I'm going to talk about a couple other things, too. The Minoan disk, the ancient Minoan disk, which is considered 4,000 years old, has apparently been partially deciphered. It's described as the Phytosis disk, and they've had it for a number of years. The Minoans are a strange civilization. We don't really understand where they come from, and some people have speculated they may have been a derivative of Atlantis or very, very, very early advanced culture. But this disk is quite unique, and scientists apparently have deciphered a portion of the disk, which apparently is a prayer. And it's unique to kind of look at because it's only a small section that's been deciphered from fragments of other Minoan documents. The rest of the of this disk is totally undecipherable, but it's beautifully rendered. The shapes and the symbols have been pushed in to this disk as kind of a reminder, or as the article describes, CD-ROM, a 4,000-year-old CD-ROM. I posted this a few weeks ago, and I really suggest taking a look at it. They're beginning to decipher more and more of this disk and other remnants from excavations in Europe. And it could be the beginning of a key clue to a mother civilization like Atlantis is known as, or an advanced civilization that had a language that we just haven't been able to figure out until recently. So this could be a good clue. The final thing I want to bring up, and by the way, Earth Ancients Radio is, and I always bring this up, is linked directly to the Facebook page. Go to Facebook and type in Earth Ancients, and then the rest of it, the subtitle is Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. And the whole focus is ancient, known, and unknown civilizations. And I want to also bring your attention to the article called Headless Figures from Chiapas, Mexico. And Chiapas is a fascinating place. There's over 400 different derivatives of Maya, different groups of Maya. And I think someone told me one time there's over 100 plus dialects of Maya, different branches of Maya that are spoken in Chiapas. And Chiapas is a special place because it is... these are Mayan groups, you know, thousands and thousands of Maya that are still alive that have been practicing their traditions for thousands of years. And when they excavate a building, those artifacts and figures that are discovered are sanctified. They're put away and they're put in museums. And unlike other parts of Central America, the most well-known area of Maya is like the Yucatan Peninsula. The looting is kept down, and there's so much of Central American ruins are looted, and the country is very poor. Mexico is very poor, and so when they find artifacts, they sell them. I've posted countless examples of amazing artifacts on auction sites like eBay and Sotheby's, and it's just such a shame. And so the opportunity to see full-size figurines, especially Mayan, is very rare. And so this article, The Headless Figures of Chiapas, Mexico, I actually show very unusual full-size figures wearing full garb, full clothing. They have yokes on, not only the yokes, but they have devices in their hands and other instrumentation that we just don't know about. We don't have a clue as to what these devices are, how they were used, and what part they played in society. But the curious thing about each of these figures is they have been beheaded. And the first thing people say is, well, they must be ball court players because they randomly beheaded the winners of the game. But the thing that makes me think that these are not ball court players is the tremendous weight of device and clothing that they're wearing. Each of them has a neck piece, it's a dressing of some kind, but they're not just pieces of shell or things like that. They're actually instrumentation of some kind. They're headsets, neck sets that are part of perhaps a helmet that we don't know about, or some other chest piece that they connect to. And then below that are these massive, massive yokes that are just so large and cumbersome that there's no way they could have used these in a ball court. Plus the fact that most of these figures are standing in front of some kind of device, some kind of instrument that we just don't have a clue at. So there's no way to date these. I'm thinking they're pre-Diluvian, pre-catastrophe. I've talked about the fact that there's areas of the Yucatan Peninsula that are partially buried, partially covered in hundreds of feet of debris, and that area, most of Mexico was covered in water probably, 10,000 years ago or longer. So anyhow, take a look at that. And as always, I suggest that you view the various portions of the Facebook fan page. There's also a fake Facebook Earth Ancients blog. It's a group page, and I tend to post more personal profiles, personal interests pieces on that, and it's kind of a fun place. And I allow participants to actually also comment there too. So today's guest, I'm really happy to present my next guest. The Giza Pyramid continues to be just a fabulous place of discovery. And a couple of weeks ago, we had Robert Bivol on, who actually wasn't really talking about the... he talked a little bit about the Giza Pyramid, but his new book on the Secret Chambers, on the Giza Pyramid revealed more about the political background of the various characters involved with cover-up, the revelation also that the National Geographic is now being looked at by the State Department, the American State Department, as contributing to some underhanded dealings, specifically with Zahi Hawass, and just a lot of shenanigans that have been going on in the Giza Pyramid. And, some people think that Zahi Hawass was a good person and that he contributed to the better understanding of the Giza Plateau and the dynastic Egyptians, but it turns out that he was kind of backhanded and repressed a lot of information, and there's a lot of things that are coming out about his dealings with discoveries especially with people who are alternative researchers like Graham Hancock and John Anthony West and Robert Breval, that were kind of underhanded. And but anyhow, our guest today is Scott Crichton, and he's written a fascinating book called The Secret Chamber of Osiris, Lost Knowledge of the 16 Pyramids. And Scott is an engineer who has traveled extensively around the world, and he actually hosts an alternative Egyptology forum on AboveTopSecret.com, and he is the co-author of The Giza Prophecy and is coming to us live today from Glasgow. How are you, Scott? How are you doing today?
Hi there, Cliff. I'm doing fine.
Great.
Good to be here.
Well, you know, yeah, we really am happy to have you. I really am interested in this book. Tell me quickly, well, not too quickly, but we don't have a lot of time to go through the whole book. The book's just filled and packed filled with tons of great information, but what was your inspiration for this book, and specifically your take on the 16 pyramids of ancient Egypt? I mean, that's a lot to bring up. Maybe what was the motivation to write the book?
Right. Okay, Cliff. Well, for me, I like mysteries, yeah. I like taking a mystery and trying to explain it. And for me, the pyramids of Egypt, the mainstream conventional view of those structures is the pyramid or the tomb of the ancient Egyptian kings and pharaohs, it just didn't stack up too well for me. And the thing is, when you start, you know, delving a little bit deeper than the surface, you begin to find things that basically just add to that confused picture that just doesn't add up. So for me, Cliff, the overwhelming drive was to try and resolve the mystery of these structures to a point where I was satisfied that, yeah, that makes sense to me now. Whereas at the moment, the conventional mainstream view of these structures just simply makes no sense to me whatsoever. You know, so that's essentially, I mean, I've always been interested in these structures, most ancient civilizations, since I was very small. But obviously, mm-hmm. The Great Pyramids of Giza, quite literally monumental. You know, I think just about everybody in the world has a level of interest in those structures, you know, to some degree. So that for me was something I felt I really had to do, was to get to the bottom of what these structures really were all about. And doing that and trying to piece together various facts that didn't really fit together that well. Essentially the book is an ancient detective story, a sort of quest, if you like, to discover this location of the secret chamber of Osiris. That's what I call it, but it's also known by other writers and researchers as the ancient Egyptian Hall of Records, which you may have heard of from various mm-hmm. other reading various other books. I mean, the Hall of Records, that's believed to be a cache of high wisdom put into a secret place in Egypt before the flood devastated the ancient kingdom. And there are numerous ancient accounts which testify to there being such a cache of ancient wisdom hidden somewhere around Giza. I mean, mm-hmm. let me give you, by way of example, we have from like the Emerald Tablets. I don't know if you're familiar with or have heard of the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. There's one little passage from the Emerald Tablets which reads this. Now, I found this really intriguing. Here it is. I'll just read it for you. Know ye that in the pyramid I builded are the keys that shall show you the way into life. Aye, draw ye a line from the great image I builded to the apex of the pyramid, built as a gateway. Draw ye another line opposite in the same angle and direction. Dig ye and find that which I have hidden. There shall ye find the underground entrance to the secrets hidden before ye were men. Now, that's just one example of the kind of fragments, the tantalizing hints of something at Giza that's been hidden away for eternity almost, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, who wouldn't love to find, you know? So,
yeah.
As I said, there's many hints to the secret cache of ancient wisdom and various other texts. Now, you mm-hmm. asked about the 16 pyramids. The secret chamber of Osiris, lost knowledge of the 16 pyramids. Now, when I was writing this book, I found it a bit difficult which way to approach it. But I decided to write it as a first-person narrative because essentially, you know, obviously I've been to Egypt and I wanted to take the reader on the journey of discovery around Egypt, you know, with myself as I was traversing the land, as it were, and you know, going to these various places and looking at various pieces of evidence. So along the way, the book reassesses this evidence with fresh eyes and covers some new and, I would say, fairly controversial evidence that casts an entirely mm-hmm. different light on why the ancient Egyptians built these first pyramids.
Right.
But essentially, the book's, it's about my own personal research for the secret chamber of Osiris down there on the ground in Egypt. And that's the thread that kind of binds the book together.
Yeah, no, I have only touched the surface of your book. It looks very well researched. And you actually reference a number of earlier authors, one being Robert Bovall. And why don't you tell us a little bit? I think you actually date the Great Pyramid significantly older than Bovall. I think Bovall dates it to about 10,000 or 9,500 BC, based on the alignment with the Orion constellation. But
yeah,
it's interesting. You actually think it's significantly older. And why don't you tell us about what you have discovered based on Bovall's discovery and how you feel that it's much, much older.
Okay. Well, Robert, as you rightly point out, he dated the structures at Giza using the Orion correlation. Now, although Robert dates it to 10,000, I think it's 10,500 BC, he still believes and accepts that they were built around 2,500 BC, but the plan, there was some plan developed around 10,500 BC. So that's essentially, I think, what Robert's position is. Now, what I've done is I've looked at Robert's theory, and there's a couple of very important parts of the jigsaw puzzle that Robert actually missed at Giza, and it's this. There's two sets of smaller pyramids at Giza, two triads of pyramids at Giza. One set of three are to the east of the Great Pyramid of Khufu, and the other three smaller pyramids are to the south of the Pyramid of Menkaure. That's the smallest of the three giant pyramids at Giza. Now, the thing about these two smaller sets is that they actually point, they also relate to Orion's Belt, the three stars of Orion's Belt, as Robert had pointed out with the main pyramids at Giza. But what mm-hmm. these two smaller sets of pyramids do is they actually point to very specific and unique points in time within the cycle, the precessional cycle of the Orion Belt stars. Now, what I mean by that is, imagine a pendulum, if you like. The stars, basically, we don't see the stars move, but they move, they basically have changed their position over great periods of time. It's known as precession. Stars don't actually move, it's actually the Earth that moves, but to an Earth-based observer, it appears that the stars move. But it's to do with this precessional wobble of the Earth. It's a 26 roughly 26,000-year wobble of the Earth. So it's a very slow wobble, but the effect of that wobble of the Earth makes it appear that the stars move very slowly over time around the horizon. Now, what happened at 23,500 BC is that the Orion Belt stars would align with the three smaller pyramids on the eastern side of Khufu's pyramid. That's when the stars are rising on the eastern horizon. They would have aligned exactly with how those pyramids appear on the eastern flank of the Great Pyramid. In 10,500 BC, that's one half cycle, roughly 13,000 years later, these stars would set on the southern horizon, southwest, roughly southwest, and they would align exactly with the Queen's Pyramids of Menkaure on the south face of Menkaure's pyramid. So essentially what you have here, if you imagine a pendulum, yeah, and there's a line beneath the pendulum. One end of this line is 12 a.m. and the other end of the line is 12 p.m. And you let the pendulum, you hold the pendulum at 12 p.m. and you release it and it swings towards 12 a.m. and then it stops, changes direction and swings back, yeah, towards 12 p.m. again, back and forth, back and forth. Essentially, precession is like that, although instead of a period of 24 hours, 12 hours one way and 12 hours back the way, what we have is a period, a line of 26,000 years, 13,000 years in one direction, 13,000 years in the reverse direction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point of these Queen's Pyramids is, if you imagine this pendulum, when you hold back, and you hold it back to 12 p.m., well, that's your unique point. That's your maximum, what's called your maximum culmination point, where the pendulum will stop, change direction, and move in the opposite direction towards 12 a.m. When it reaches 12 a.m., the pendulum will stop, change direction, and swing back again, back towards 12 p.m.
Okay.
So this is
so that's
these are
yeah
your,
that
these are your turning points, and that's what these two sets of Queen's Pyramids represent, the turning points of Orion's Belt.
But you're taking all 16 pyramids and using those as a landmarker rather than Bouval, who uses the Queen's Chamber shafts to point to the various star systems. Is that correct?
Well,
because you're dating it significantly older than anyone has talked about to this point, 19,000 years ago.
What I was going to say, Cliff, was that with this precession line that we have between these two markers, the Sphinx happens to bisect the exact midpoint between these two sets of markers at Giza, these two sets of smaller pyramids. The Sphinx bisects exactly the midpoint between these two, the line between these two sets. And that date is 16940 BC, which that is how I have dated the structures, using the precession, the maximum and minimum culmination, and the Sphinx, using the Sphinx as the hand of the clock, so to speak. It points to a certain precession along this line, and it's 16940 BC. So that's how I date the structures. But what I'm saying, Cliff, is that there was a plan by the ancient Egyptian civilization of roughly 19,000 years ago. And the ancient Egyptians tell us that their civilization is a lot older. They claim their civilization is roughly about 40,000 years old. You know, so I don't see why, modern mainstream Egyptology just ignores that. You know, I think we should actually listen to what the ancient Egyptian texts tell us rather than us sitting here in the 21st century saying, oh, well, that's just ridiculous. That can't be, because it doesn't fit in with our Darwinian paradigm of history. You know, so I take the view that, well, let's see if this is actually correct. So I think the civilization was a lot older, much, much older, and something happened around 19,000 years ago that caused the ancient
Let's talk about that, because in your book, you talk about the prophecy of catastrophe and the creation of the pyramids, and you actually, in your pyramids, to serve the heritage of the people who built the pyramids. Is that correct?
Yeah, you were breaking up just a little bit there, Cliff. I didn't quite catch all of what you said.
I said that in your theory, you believe the pyramids were created to house the memory, the heritage of the people who built it, as a prelude to a catastrophe. So tell us about that.
Right. Okay. The ancient Egyptians, basically, there's a number of ancient Egyptian texts which come down to us via the Arab peoples, the ancient Arab peoples, preserved these texts, much like they did with a lot of Western texts, like Plato and Socrates, came back to Europe the Arabs who preserved these texts. Well, they also preserved some ancient Egyptian texts as well. And one of those texts tells us that an ancient Egyptian king called Saurid saw that the stars in the heavens had moved out of their normal course, out of their place. And he asked his astronomer priests, what does this mean? Now, the priests all assembled, and the head astronomer priest told the king, it means in 300 years' time there will be a massive flood which will drown the entire country. It will also be followed by a devastating drought. King Saurid then instructed, upon hearing this from the priest, then instructed that they build a number of pyramids, and in these pyramids they would preserve everything that they needed to rebuild their civilization again after the worst effects of this deluge had passed. And so he ordered the construction of pyramids, and inside these pyramids they put everything, they put seeds, wheat, barley, grape, date, tomato, all manner of seed types. They put tools, they put papyri, they put weapons, they put everything in these what I call recovery vaults, pyramid recovery vaults, to ensure that their civilization could recover, could reboot itself, if you like, after the worst effects of this deluge had passed. And so they set about, I reckon the plan to build 16 of these pyramids, because this relates into the myth of Osiris. Osiris was the ancient Egyptian god of rebirth, of regeneration. He was also the god of grain. Now, Osiris, as this god, I don't know exactly, obviously I can't say, but I suspect Osiris was probably in charge of this project, if you like, of ensuring that these structures contained everything that was needed to reboot the system. Now, the decision to build 16 of these, this would be from the Step Pyramid, that was the first pyramid that they built, all the way to the last pyramid at Giza. That would be G3, the Menkaure's pyramid, and its three small satellite pyramids. So that's the 16 pyramids. And this is where I think we get the myth passed down to us, the myth of Osiris, where apparently his brother Seth was jealous of Osiris, and Seth wanted the throne for himself. So Seth caused chaos, and he drowned Osiris, and then he cut the body of Osiris into 16 pieces, and he scattered these 16 pieces across the land of Egypt. I got to thinking, I wonder if actually this is an allegorical tale, basically that Osiris, these dismembered 16 parts of Osiris, is actually the 16 pyramids. You know, like today, and you know, the Christian church, it's often said that the church is the body of Christ. Yeah? A similar
right,
idea.
Yeah.
The pyramid was essentially the body of Osiris, cut into 16 pieces. And that gets us from, or 16 completed pyramids, that gets us from the Step Pyramid to the Pyramid of Menkaure, the giant pyramids. Yeah? Thereafter, mm-hmm. the pyramids gradually, you know, were reduced in size. You know, so, and if you look at the pyramid texts, these are ancient religious texts, or the oldest religious texts we have in the world today. If you look at the ancient mm-hmm. Egyptian pyramid texts, what do we find? It says quite explicitly, this pyramid is Osiris. This construction is Osiris. You know, so there's evidence there, right there, that the even the ancient Egyptians themselves viewed the pyramids, probably allegorically as well, as Osiris. Now,
mm-hmm.
the curious thing is that when you plot the locations of these 16 pyramids onto a Google map or a map of Egypt, what you find is that, I don't know, Cliff, if you've ever seen the sort of classic Osiris image, you know, is standing, you know, like a mummy, but with a crown on his head with three prongs. It's called the Atif crown, and the third prong, the middle one, is slightly taller or longer than the other three, and he's got the crook and flail crossed over his arms. Are you familiar with that?
I think maybe I've seen a statue like that, but
yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a classic classic Osiris image. The other thing as well, you'll sometimes see his face is green or black. The green represented the fertile Nile Valley, and the black represented the fertile silt of the Nile Valley. The white, his body was used with white, I suspect represented the white stones, the outer casing of the pyramid. Now, if you plot the first 16 completed pyramids by the ancient Egyptians onto a map of Giza, that actually create a crude matchstick outline of the classic Osiris figurine. Quite remarkable. I mean, I only discovered that by accident. I just had a brainwave one night, and I thought, I wonder what would happen if, and I tried it, and there it was. You know, so I'm not saying that, I don't know which way round did these 16 pyramids create the classic figure, or did they have the classic figure and they matched the pyramids to lay out like that. I don't think that's the case. I think it's probably the overriding factor for the placement of the pyramids would be the mm-hmm. access to quarries and such like. So I suspect that the location of these 16 pyramids, you know, with the three-pronged Atif crown and the cross crook and flail, these were probably built, obviously, first, and the classic Osiris figure came much later.
Mm-hmm.
But based on the knowledge that the ancient Egyptians had of these first 16 pyramids as the body of Osiris. The remarkable thing is, if you look at what we actually find in these pyramids, Cliff, take the Step Pyramid at Saqqara, the first one that the ancient Egyptians built. They never found any body of any ancient Egyptian king in that pyramid. What they did mm-hmm. find was massive, and I mean massive amounts of grain. The underground complex of the Step Pyramid is huge. There's corridors that are literally kilometres long. Yeah, they're really, really long.
Really?
There's all sorts of passageways and galleries under the Step Pyramid. And the first explorers that entered that pyramid in the early 19th century, they were wading through these corridors through, you know, shin deep through, you know, massive amounts of grain.
Wow.
Under this pyramid. And not only that, but in this pyramid, they found something like 40,000, not 10 or 20 or 100 or 200, 40,000 storage vessels. Yeah. To hold water.
You mean jars? Jars or things like that?
Yeah. Well, not just jars, but jars. You know, large, small, but plates and all sorts of various different types of vessel. 40,000 of them. You know, if you look at the Great Pyramid, there's in the book I present not primary evidence, secondary evidence of the Great Pyramid having once stored massive amounts of grain. I won't get into the detail of that here, but there's also some good secondary evidence to suggest that the Great Pyramid also once stored massive amounts of grain. As I am saying, all these first 16 pyramids did, because they were the body of Osiris. What we find as well, Cliff, is that later dynasties of the ancient Egyptian civilization, what do we find them doing at their festivals? There's one festival called the Festival of Koyak. And what the ancient Egyptians did during this festival is that they would make a small effigy of Osiris of linen and mud. And what they would do is they would fill this effigy, it would only be about maybe 12 or 18 inches tall. They would pack it full with seed, various types of seeds, this effigy of Osiris. Yeah. And what they would then do is they would place it in the ground and place a large rock on top of it. Sometimes what they would also do is they would have small stone containers, again about 18 or 20 inches long, and they would just fill it with earth. They would fill it with earth and place some seeds on top. And then they would bury that in the ground and place a large rock on top of it.
Fascinating.
But here's the thing, Cliff. What did they find in G2? That's the second pyramid at Giza, the one in the middle, yeah? That's the pyramid of Khafre. What did they find in there? Belzoni, in 1818, when he entered that pyramid and he opened what Egyptologists call the sarcophagus. It's not what I call a sarcophagus. I call it a nebank, which I believe is a different thing. They found that box, that stone container, filled to the brim with earth.
Wow.
That was all. No body, just earth and some stones. And that.
So you believe those pyramids were containers for the rebirth of the civilization through some horrible catastrophe. It's fascinating. I want to ask you this, which is on my mind and probably on a lot of people's mind. Do you believe Osiris was a real person? And if so, what have you discovered in terms of his culture? Because that would be pre-dynastic Egyptians. And these were unique people to have had the engineering prowess to build those massive structures.
Yeah. Well, the only text that we can Cliff, with any sort of information about Osiris is the pyramid texts. But one of I do believe that Osiris probably was a real person. Much like Imhotep was a real person, but who became a god much later in ancient Egyptian history. He was an ordinary guy. He was the vizier of Zoser, King Zoser, who later became deified much later in Egyptian history. He became a god. I think Osiris was probably very much in a similar situation, because if you look at the pyramid texts, Cliff, what you find is that in the early pyramid texts, Osiris, you're talking about the earliest pyramid texts, you're talking about probably 150, 200 years after the Great Pyramid was built. So you're talking about probably 5th dynasty. These are when we get the first written texts about Osiris. And he was already a god in these texts. Yeah.
Right.
So he was obviously revered for a very, very long time before these texts were written down. You know, so this is one of the reasons why I think the pyramids are much, much older, because if the pyramids are the body of Osiris, you don't become a god overnight in the 5th dynasty. You know, this takes a long, long time to occur. So that's one of the other reasons why I think, Osiris was probably a living, breathing person at some point. He may have been the Minister for Agriculture, for all I know, but he was very much connected with grain, and specifically the grain within the pyramid. And
do you find a connection between Osiris and a much more sophisticated civilization than the dynastic Egyptians? I mean, if you date the pyramids to 19,000 BC, is
17,000
significantly.
BC.
I'm sorry, what was it again?
Yeah, it's 17,000.
Yeah, okay, 17,000 BC.
Era. Yeah.
So, 19,000 years ago, that is beyond any understanding we have of dynastic Egyptians. So, who were these people? Where did they come from? They're pre-Diluvian, apparently, according to you. Who are these people?
Well, that's a great mystery, Cliff, and that's one of the things I love about researching this stuff. It's what Graham's a good friend of mine, Graham Hancock, he calls or refers to as, we are a species with amnesia. There's a lost chapter in our history. We don't know who these people are. The ancient Egyptians, themselves in their text, they tell us that their civilization is much, much older. I genuinely believe they probably were the proto-Egyptians, if you like. I am saying that the ancient Egyptian civilization is much, much older. The ancient Egyptians built the pyramids, but not in 2500 BCE, but way, way back. Long, long ago. We have lost a chunk of data. We have lost a big chunk of history. And basically, I think what's happened is during the first intermediate period, this is between the Old Kingdom and the Middle Kingdom, the first intermediate period, the mainstream Egyptologists tell us it only lasted a couple of hundred years. Well, I think it could have lasted a lot, lot longer. Is a what they call a dark age, where we don't know very much. Something, some disaster happened in Egypt. Well, I think it's all got a bit muddied, and I think that period was much, much longer than a couple of hundred years. Basically all that's happened is that these structures have been pulled forward in time to the era of 2500 BC. But that is not what the evidence that I'm looking at tells me. These people built these structures to survive a deluge that they believe is coming because something they saw happening in the skies. And the interesting thing also, Cliff, is that 19,000 years ago is roughly about the time when the great North American and European ice sheets started to melt. And we don't know what happened to trigger that. I think it may have been the same event that triggered that event, that the ancient Egyptians saw the same thing in the sky. They realized that because, or the priests realized, however they managed to work that out, that it would bring a devastating flood. And they prepared for it. And that's what these structures are all about. And there's other evidence in the book as well, Cliff, that points quite clearly to the shafts, for example. Robert Bavall has in his book the shafts pointing to Orion's Belt and Sirius. Well, the Orion's Belt, one shaft and the King's Southern Shaft and the King's Chamber pointing to Al-Nitak in Orion's Belt, well, that was discovered by Virginia Trimble and Alexander Bodaway in the 1960s. It was Robert Laval that discovered the Queen's Chamber Southern Shaft pointing to Sirius. Well, what I'm saying is, no, I don't think that's right. I think Virginia Trimble was right in that the King's Chamber Southern Shaft points to Al-Nitak, but I think also the lower shaft also pointed to Al-Nitak. And what they're showing is this change in the position of Al-Nitak over a very short period of time. In other words, they're showing how the skies changed, the stars moved out of their place. It was here, and then it moved to here. That's what they're showing with those shafts. And the remarkable thing is, it's a difference in those shafts of 6 degrees. Yeah, but if the pole moved, this is what I'm saying, in the book also, there's a couple of Norwegian researchers who have written a couple of very, very interesting papers about what they call rapid pole wander. There's true polar wander. They call this rapid true polar wander. True polar wander happens and it basically shifts the Earth's pole, but over an extremely long period of time, something like 1 degree in a million years. What these guys are saying is that, no, it happens much, much quicker than that. And they postulate in their papers that the 20,000, roughly 19,000 years ago, they're saying that the Earth's pole was in roughly the center of Greenland, which would be the actual center of the ice sheet, the North American ice sheet then. It would roughly have been the center of the ice sheet. And it moved to the Arctic Sea. The pole moved. Now, that's a difference of 18 degrees, roughly 18 degrees. So I'm thinking, well, why are these shafts in the Great Pyramid? Why are they only showing 6 degrees if the pole moved 18 degrees? But then I realized the Earth's tilted. It's tilted at 23.5 degrees. And when you measure that on a map, on Google Earth, wherever, the distance from Giza to Greenland and then from Giza to the present pole in the Arctic Ocean is actually a distance of 6 degrees, exactly what the shafts in the Great Pyramid show us. So, this is, I'm tying all these different little threads of or snippets that have been passed down to us from various different sources and joining them all together, connecting them. You know, why is there a box of Earth in G2, the second Khafre's pyramid? Why did they find a box of Earth in it? Because this was a Chthonic religion. It wasn't about the burial of the king at all. It was about the rebirth of the Earth and that box of Earth in that second pyramid was most likely, in my opinion, the original content of that pyramid. And the reason it survived, the reason that Earth survived in that box cliff, it didn't disappear, was because unusually I think it's the only stone box in any pyramid which has this, the box is set into the floor. It can't be tipped over. That is why the Earth survived in the box.
Let's talk a little bit about your discovery of the techniques for the pyramid. You're an engineer. You've seen these massive stone structures. The Great Pyramid of Giza, the average block of stone is 2.5 tons, and it's risen or put up to over 200 feet in the air. How do you theorize they did that? What was the techniques? Everybody is questioning this massive structure was built, and with such precision. I mean, this is engineering on a scale that we have no concept of. So, how do you think?
Truly, it's truly astonishing. Obviously, there are all sorts of theories out there, Cliff, from the mundane to the total outlandish theories, my starting point, obviously, as an engineer is, I look for evidence first and foremost. I look for evidence. I didn't find a lot of evidence for ramps. I found evidence of small ramps that maybe go from the quarry up to maybe the base of the pyramid. But there's no evidence that I have ever read of where there is any massive ramps. Remember, these ramps, for take the Great Pyramid as an example, the construction of that ramp would have been as big a project as the construction of the pyramid itself. You know, so I'm thinking, if this legend is true, that they had 300 years, you know, to build these 16 pyramids, yeah? They would need to develop a means to lift really heavy stones. Now, they would need to be heavy stones, because if they made them quite small, where a single person could lift them, that's a lot more cutting of these stones to make the stones smaller and more manageable. And the you know, so that's a time constraint there, you know. So I'm thinking from a practical point of view, if they made them too big, they would become unmanageable, you know. They wouldn't. So they had to make them a size where they were manageable within a very specific lifting technology. Now, what technology could that be? It would need to be a technology that wasn't as big a construction project as the pyramid itself. It would need to be available practically from day one. Yeah? It would need to be able to lift probably two of these blocks at a time. Yeah? Now, I've come up with a theory, and it is just a theory. I don't say that this is how they did it. I just, you know, well, here's my thoughts, and I just throw it out there. I discovered this ancient legend by the ancient Egyptians, which talks of the stones flew into place. It says that the stone was covered with a piece of paper, and then it flew into place. Now, you think, well, that sounds bizarre. Now, I've heard some theories where, you know, people have some sort of anti-gravity devices and, you know, some sonic levitation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exotic signs going on, which doesn't jar for me at all. It just doesn't jive for me whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need things that the ancient Egyptians could do, as I understand, you know, the ancient Egyptians. You know, maybe they did have such technology, but we don't have any evidence of it. What we do have evidence of is that the ancient Egyptians had linen, they had paper, they had fire, they had rope, they were masters of sails. And I got to thinking, I read an article one day about the Montgolfier brothers, who built the world's first hot air balloon. I thought, what can a hot air balloon lift? And what was the Montgolfier balloon, what was it made of? And it turns out it was made of the first hot air balloon in modern times. The ancient Chinese apparently had balloon technology, you know, 2,500 years ago for signalling. Now, the Montgolfier balloon was made of linen and paper and ropes and a basket. And these were all things that the ancient Egyptians, well, the linen and the paper, they invented or discovered, you know. So I'm thinking, well, how did the Montgolfiers, you know, connect a balloon with flight? And it turns out it's remarkably simple. If you just look at a fire, you know, a burning fire with, you know, logs on it, you'll see, you know, pieces of charcoal or ash rising up in the flames, in the hot air, in the flames. And if you notice that, and if you've got an inquiring mind like mine, you'll say, why does that happen? And that's exactly what the Montgolfier brothers did. And they then thought, well, if we could trap hot air in an envelope of some kind, and so they did, and then they realised that created lift, thermodynamics. They discovered, you know, how thermodynamics can create lift, and they, I think they lifted a sheep, a rooster and a duck for about 10 minutes and then landed it back in the ground again. So there you have, you know, a technology that the ancient Egyptians could have developed, because they had all the materials, and it's a technology that could be available virtually from day one. Now, what can a balloon lift? Well, I did some calculations, and it turns out that if you take just a standard spherical balloon, the balloon doesn't have to be spherical in shape. It could be virtually any shape whatsoever, just as long as the volume, the capacity had enough lift, hot air, to lift these stones. It turns out that a spherical balloon of 125 feet diameter can lift something like 6.3 tons. Now, the average block, as you mentioned earlier, Cliff, is about 2.5 tons. So with the weight of the materials, the linen, the ropes, etc., the netting for loading the stone, you could safely lift two of these blocks for the Great Pyramid. And
I misunderstood you, Scott. How big does this balloon have to be to lift 3 tons? It must be a monstrous balloon.
Well,
how big are we talking?
As I said, 125 feet diameter balloon.
Oh, 125 feet. Okay. Oh my God.
Diameter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a sphere. Yeah. Will lift two of these blocks. Now, the Great Pyramid is about 740 feet. Each side is roughly about 740 feet long. So you could comfortably have four of these stationed along each side of the pyramid. And obviously, you know, you would need a special type of fire also, because you couldn't have just a normal fire. You would need a fire that was in a pit, a deep pit, but that was fed air in a convection current from another pit built alongside, parallel with a small U-connector at the bottom to create a draft of air, a sort of U-shape, to create a convection current. And the remarkable thing is, Cliff, there's a number of these all over the Giza Plateau, and nobody really knows
these
what
pits?
They're called.
The pits, you mean?
Yeah. And you can go onto the internet, you can Google Dakota fire pit. They still use them today. They're called Dakota fire pits today. But the ancient Egyptians had versions of them where these pits were 20, 30 feet deep. And the good thing about them is, because they're not buffeted by the wind, and because they burn a lot hotter, because they're getting fed a draft of air, they're burning really fiercely, there's very little smoke, and they burn a lot hotter, and there's much less likelihood of the balloon itself, you know, going up in a ball of flames, you know. So, so there are those pits around Giza. But the other thing as well is that if you look, I'm not sure. Are you familiar, Cliff, with the Dendera? They call it the Dendera light bulb. It's this thing that looks like a light bulb, and it's in the
famous carving in the wall.
Yeah, that shows the
light bulb.
Yeah, the Temple of Hathor. It's in the Temple of Hathor at Dendera. And it basically looks like a light bulb. And this is what a lot of people have theorized over the years, that the ancient Egyptians. But if you actually look at it a bit closer and look at the other elements in the particular scene, you have Horus, who's the god of the sky. You have various other Egyptian deities. The snake within the so-called light bulb is the god of air. And there's some text alongside it which talks about the sky carriers. Now, the balloon is, I think it's actually one of these early balloons that are basically being flighted and being sort of filled, inflated. And it's actually attached to a block as well. And if you look elsewhere in the Temple of Dendera, you'll find the same shapes, these balloon shapes, but they're no longer horizontal, being filled with air. They're actually vertical, and they've got a basket of stones below them. Yeah?
And I haven't seen that.
Yeah, well, it's in my book. You know, so...
Okay,
and
very good. Published.
The book's not published until released till the 22nd of December. So
yeah, I gotta make sure that our guests know that this book that we're talking about, The Secret Chamber of Osiris, is not gonna be out for at least another month and a half. So this is a prelude, but I'll tell you, from what I've read, it's an amazing look at ancient Egypt. Scott, we have just a few minutes left. I want to let you tell us what you feel are the real key discoveries that you've made. Maybe highlight them quickly in a short kind of a synopsis. Maybe one, two, or three points, without giving away the whole book, obviously. But what have you discovered are the real keys to your research, and that this is really critical.
Okay.
Want to continue reading?
Well, one of the key things of this new book that I have coming out, The Secret Chamber of Osiris Cliff, is my research concerning the markings in the Great Pyramid discovered by Colonel Howard Weiss and Richard Howard Weiss in 1837. I've found Howard Weiss's handwritten journal, his field notes, if you like, from his time in Egypt in 1837, when he apparently discovered these markings. Now, I won't reveal everything here, but there's the book contains evidence from his handwritten notes, which proves beyond a reasonable doubt, as far as I'm concerned, that Zechariah Sitchin's claim that these marks were faked by Weiss to be absolutely true, that these marks in these structures, The Khufu cartouche particularly, is highly suspect. There's new evidence, never before seen evidence in this book, that proves, to my mind, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Howard Weiss faked these marks in 1837 in order to connect the Great Pyramid to Khufu and then to the year of 2500 BC. There's a whole load of things in this book, Cliff, but that is the thing that undermines the entire body of Egyptology, because that inscription is the only piece of empirical evidence that Egyptology has to connect that structure to Khufu and thus to the year 2500 BC. And I found compelling evidence straight from Howard Weiss's own hand that he faked those markings. And that is in the book.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah. So
that's a huge discovery. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a couple of articles in Atlantis Rising earlier in the year about that, Cliff, but there's a lot more about it in the book.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's huge because, as I said, it undermines the whole paradigm.
Well, it dates it. He wanted to. Why would someone do such a thing? Why? I mean, that's just horrible.
Yeah. Well, Howard Weiss himself, as the book goes into his past and his early days, shows that he was originally a politician. And he was elected on the basis of electoral fraud. He basically bought his way to power. He bought something like 938 or 932 votes, something like that, out of 1,010 votes. He bought, the vast majority of votes to get into power. It's basically, he bribed his way, to get what he wanted. So we're not dealing here with a guy that... There are a lot of scruples. No, you're dealing with somebody who would do what he needed to do to get what he wanted to happen.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, listen, we have just a little more time. Do you have one other point? I asked for 1 to 3. Why don't you give us one more key to the secret chambers of Osiris that you think are because you just lit up a fire here with this Howard Weiss revelation, but of course Sitchin had talked about it earlier, but
the other key thing is connecting all the dots. That's what this book does, Cliff. It connects a lot of different dots from different points in history. It shows how the belt stars. Robert Bivol, yeah, he saw the pattern was the same as the Three Pyramids, but what he didn't see was that you could actually take those three stars and using a very simple dot-to-dot technique and no more than, I think, 10 steps, you can create the three bases of the pyramids from those three dots. So not only do you have the three dots looking like the same layout as the pyramids, the same pattern, but you can actually take those three dots and using a very dot-to-dot technique, simple technique, systematic technique, you can recreate the three bases from those three dots. So there's a whole lot of stuff in this book, Cliff, that will just blow your mind. You know, it really, you know, it will capture your imagination. And the other thing as well, the whole thing about the book is it's a quest. It's about me looking for this secret chamber. Where could it be? And the conclusion at the end is eye-opening.
Fantastic.
Did I find it? Yes, I found it. And the conclusion at the end of the book, you know, it will really open your eyes at what's going on.
Fantastic. My guest has been Scott Crichton. His book, The Secret Chamber of Osiris, Lost Knowledge of the 16 Pyramids. Scott, I think you got real fire here. I am definitely going to be promoting this when it comes out in the next few weeks. And are you going to be at any lecturing coming up that you can tell us about? Are you going to be appearing anywhere? Any promotions that you can tell us about?
I don't have anything planned yet. I'm actually in the middle of working on my next book, Cliff. You know, so I'm doing a lot of research for that at the moment. But obviously, you know, if I have anything planned stateside, I'll be sure to let yourself and your listeners know.
Very good. Pleasure having you on the show, and continue great luck. And the book is really fascinating. I'm looking forward to really digging in now, and looking at it. And we hope to hear real great things about you, Scott. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Great. So that was Scott, and that's it for today's program. Next week, I encourage you all to listen in. My guest is Steve Meads, who has discovered a big connection between dynastic Egypt and the surface of Mars, the civilizations of Mars, as well as some Earth-based discoveries that I think you'll be quite fascinated with. So I wish you all a great day, and we will talk to you again.